BBC World Service. Welcome to World Briefing with Marion Marshall. The headlines at 7 o'clock GMT. FBI officials have identified the gunman who shot dead two people at Los Angeles Airport before being killed by security guards from the Israeli airline El Al. They say he was an Egyptian limousine driver living in the United States. The government of Nepal says a number of people have been injured in a bomb blast at the offices of the new political party set up by the Prime Minister. Iraqi and United Nations officials are holding more talks today in Vienna on the return of UN weapons inspectors to Iraq. And in sport, at the Wimbledon Tennis Championships, the world number one, Leighton Hewitt, will meet Britain's Tim Henman in the semi-finals later today, weather permitting. This is the BBC in London. First, we'll have a look at the top stories in detail.
BBC News with Michael Poles. A gunman has shot dead two people at Los Angeles International Airport before being killed himself. The incident occurred at the ticket counter of the Israeli airline El Al, and police say the gunman was shot dead by airline security personnel. David Willis reports from Los Angeles.
FBI officials say the man was standing quietly in line at the El Al ticket counter when he suddenly drew a gun and started firing. He shot and killed a 20-year-old female ticket agent and a 46-year-old man, both of whom are thought to be Israelis, before being overpowered by two El Al security agents and a member of the public. During the struggle, the man continued shooting wildly, injuring four other people before he himself was shot and killed. He was carrying two handguns and a 6-inch knife, but no identification.
FBI officials have now revealed more details about the gunman. They say he was a 41-year-old Egyptian limousine driver who had lived in the United States since 1992. The man was not a US citizen, but a resident alien. The shooting happened despite unprecedented security across the United States, as the country celebrated Independence Day for the first time since the attacks of September the 11th. But Americans appeared undaunted, with a generally cautious reaction to the shooting at Los Angeles Airport. From Washington, Justin Webb reports.
The initial reaction of the Israeli government to the shooting at Los Angeles and the initial reaction of the Bush administration were hugely different. The Israelis were quick to call it a terrorist incident, but from Washington there was silence. The view in the administration is that it's far too early to make any judgment about what the motives for this attack might have been. That view appears to have been accepted by the American public. Undaunted by the attack, Americans flocked in large numbers to the National Mall in the center of Washington and to other gatherings around the nation for the traditional 4th of July fireworks shows last night. The truth is that many people here are relieved that one apparently isolated shooting was the only serious violence reported yesterday. They had feared much worse.
Talks between United Nations and Iraqi officials on the return of weapons inspectors to the country are set to resume in Vienna today. Iraq is said to have requested answers on when UN sanctions against it could be lifted in the event of inspectors returning. The two sides said the first day of talks on Thursday took place in a positive and serious atmosphere. You're listening to the news from the BBC. A bomb has exploded at an office in the Nepalese capital, Kathmandu, used by the new party of the Prime Minister, Shebahadur Deoba. A government minister is quoted as saying that at least six people have been injured, some of them seriously. Mr. Deoba is said not to have been present at the time. There's no indication so far as to who might have carried out the attack, though Maoist rebels have been engaged in a long-running insurgency against the Nepalese authorities. The authorities in Cuba have posted extra police patrols along its northern coastline after persistent rumours that large numbers of local people are seeking to leave the island using boats sent from the United States. Fidel Castro's government says anyone caught sailing to Cuba to do so would be prosecuted for human trafficking. From Havana, Daniel Schweimler reports.
For the past few days, rumours have been circulating around Cuban towns and cities that Cuban exiles in the United States would be sending boats to pick up those who wanted to leave the island. The US Coast Guard in Miami has warned that Cubans could be putting themselves in danger if they tried to illegally enter the United States by sea. It said the Florida Straits is a dangerous, rough area to navigate, especially in overcrowded or unseaworthy vessels. The resolve of some has been increased by threats made last week by President Fidel Castro that he may close the US diplomatic mission in Havana, accusing some who work there of sowing discontent among the Cuban people.
Leaders from 10 East European countries hoping to join NATO will meet representatives of the military alliance in the Latvian capital Riga today. The meeting is the last before a summit in November at which NATO will decide which applicants have been successful. Latvia and its Baltic neighbours, Estonia and Lithuania, are being seen as the favourites, having built up their armed forces from scratch since they won independence from the Soviet Union. The Chilean President Ricardo Lagos says the resignation of the former military leader General Augusto Pinochet from his post as a lifetime senator will bring tranquility to the country. Mr. Lagos said General Pinochet's move will allow Chileans to concentrate on the issues of the future. In tennis, it's men's semi-finals day at Wet Wimbledon Tennis Championships here in London, with most attention focused on the clash between the number one seed, Australian Leighton Hewitt, and Britain's Tim Henman, who's ranked fourth. In the other semi-final, David Nalbandian from Argentina meets the Belgian player Xavier Malis. BBC News.
It's 7.06 GMT. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC with Marion Marshall. The United States was on high alert as the 4th of July approached. Following the events of September the 11th, it had been widely predicted that supporters of Al-Qaeda would use Independence Day to launch further attacks. So, when a gunman opened fire near the check-in counter for the Israeli airline El Al at Los Angeles International Airport, many feared the worst. Ian Pannell reports on how the United States has reacted to this attack.
From ABC News, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings.
We're going to begin in Los Angeles because late this morning there was a shooting at the counter of the
attack took place at one of America's busiest airports at the start of a holiday season that's been dominated by fears about terrorism. A gunman approached the El Al ticket counter and opened fire. Within minutes, he'd killed an airline clerk. And reports suggest that El Al security officers returned fire, killing the attacker. Three people were left with wounds, and one died later.
A man opened fire and had shot at two women. One had died, and the other woman is in critical condition, taken to the hospital. But the security guard did shoot the shooter, but they do believe that there may be another suspect at large.
With the country on a high state of alert, with unprecedented security measures in place for Independence Day, the initial conclusion was that this must have been a terrorist attack. But the governor of California, the police, and the mayor of the city, James Hahn, all appeared before the cameras to dampen speculation.
We have no information that indicates that this incident is connected to any terrorist event or anything else, but the matter is under investigation right now and will continue to be so under FBI.
But for its part, the Israeli government has been unequivocal, describing the shooting as a terrorist attack. It's a conclusion shared by the relatives of one of the LA victims.
It was a terrorist attack because the guy that was standing right there, he saw an Arab guy standing right there that he was shooting the bullets right in the counter lady and my brother-in-law, okay? So it's not a mafia thing, and it's not about an Armenian guy that lost his job. This is a terrorist attack, okay? They're hitting us back at home, now they're hitting us back over here.
There was much riding on the country's ability to celebrate an incident-free Independence Day. So officials like California Governor Gray Davis were quick to encourage people to carry on as usual.
I'm going to continue with my plans, and I want to urge Californians to continue with theirs. The best way to let people around the world know that we're not going to cower in fear is to go on with our plans on this America's special day, the 4th of July.
That report from Ian Pannell in Washington. The United Nations is keen to secure the return of its weapons inspectors to Iraq in order to avert possible future sources for international conflict. Talks on the issue will continue in the Austrian capital Vienna today, but despite some cautious optimism about yesterday's discussions, it's still not clear whether a deal can be reached. From Vienna, here's Bethany Bell.
The United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan and the Iraqi Foreign Minister Naji Sabri both expressed satisfaction at the way this new round of talks have begun. The UN wants to see its inspectors return to Iraq after a ban of 3.5 years, and officials said the arms experts are standing by. When asked if anything would come out of the two-day meeting, Mr. Annan smiled and said, Insha'Allah, the Arabic word for God willing. But Mr. Sabri said his government still wanted a range of issues to be considered, including threats by the United States to overthrow the Iraqi president Saddam Hussein. For its part, the UN has made it clear that it's focusing mainly on the question of the return of the arms inspectors. A breakthrough, or the conclusive decisions Mr. Annan said he was hoping for at the end of today's meeting, are by no means assured.
Bethany Bell reporting from Vienna. You're listening to the BBC in London. Today's main news: FBI officials have identified the gunman who shot dead two people at Los Angeles Airport before being killed by security guards from the Israeli airline El Al. They say he was an Egyptian limousine driver living in the United States. The government of Nepal says a number of people have been injured in a bomb blast at the offices of the new political party set up by the Prime Minister. Leaders from 10 East European countries hoping to join NATO are meeting representatives of the military alliance in the Latvian capital Riga today. The meeting is the last before a summit in November, at which NATO will decide which applicants have been successful. From Riga, here's Nicholas Walton.
This summit meeting is a chance for each of the 10 countries hoping to join NATO to gauge the progress of their applications. The host country, Latvia, along with its Baltic neighbours Estonia and Lithuania, have built up their national armed forces from scratch in the years since winning independence from the Soviet Union. All three, plus Slovenia, are near the top of many observers' lists of those likely to have their applications accepted. The chances of two other countries, Bulgaria and Romania, are widely thought to have greatly improved after the support that they gave to the United States and its allies in the war against terror. Two others, Albania and Macedonia, are believed to have the hardest job because of continuing instability within each country and within the Balkans. The other applicants are Croatia and Slovakia.
Nicholas Walton reporting from Riga. The Prime Minister of Croatia is expected to resign today, following rows between the two main parties in the country's ruling coalition. It's widely thought that the Prime Minister, Ivica Račan, will be asked to form a new government soon afterwards. Earlier this week, Mr. Račan said he could no longer work with the coalition in its present form. Our correspondent Matthew Price reports from the Croatian capital, Zagreb.
2.5 years after it came to power, Croatia's ruling coalition cabinet is likely in the next few hours to hold its last meeting in its present form. After the meeting, Prime Minister Ivica Račan, it's thought, will step down. Political observers here in Zagreb believe Croatia's president will then ask Mr. Račan to form a new government. He would then have 30 days to propose a new cabinet. If he cannot gain support, early general elections would be held. It seemed increasingly likely during the week that Mr. Račan would resign. He's been angered by members of the Social Liberal Party, one of the five parties within the ruling coalition, who have refused to support a number of government initiatives. The row deepened this week when most of the Social Liberals in Parliament refused to support a controversial nuclear power plant bill.
Matthew Price reporting from Zagreb. There have been disturbances in the northern French town of Lille after a policeman, who shot dead an Algerian man 2 years ago, received a suspended 3-year prison sentence. Some vehicles were reportedly set alight and police were pelted with stones and bottles by groups of youths. The policeman was accused of the murder of 25-year-old Riyad Hamlawi, but yesterday the court in Douai, south of Lille, convicted him of manslaughter. The disturbances coincide with the 40th anniversary today of Algeria's independence from France, the fruit of a long struggle in which hundreds of thousands of Algerians were killed. After independence, Algeria became a third world leader and a source of support for other liberation struggles. But in the last decade, the country has been torn apart by political violence, pitting Islamic militants against the army-backed state. Ebba Saleh reflects on what went wrong.
As they mark the 40th anniversary of their independence from France, many Algerians will probably remember that there was a time when the name of their country conjured up hope. In the 60s and 70s, Algeria was a third world beacon. Liberation movements around the world drew inspiration from its people's epic struggle for freedom. At home, the new socialist Algerian state pursued ambitious development plans. Internationally, it had prestige as a leading light of the non-aligned movement. But all this is long gone. The country's experiment with political liberalization went badly wrong. An Islamist party was about to win the first ever pluralist legislative elections in 1991 when the army aborted the poll. Radical Islamists took up arms unleashing an insurgency in which more than 100,000 people have been killed. Algeria now has the trappings of a democracy, but real power remains in the hands of factions in the army and intelligence services.
Heba Saleh reporting. Three-quarters of new HIV infections between now and the year 2010 could be prevented if proven prevention programs were implemented globally, according to a report written by a multinational group of experts convened by the UN and just published in The Lancet. The cost would be significant, but the report says such a global program would save money as well as lives in the long term. Our science correspondent Richard Black has more.
If current trends continue, another 45 million people will be infected with HIV by the end of the decade. But some countries have managed to restrain the epidemic through comprehensive prevention campaigns. And the report says that if such programs could be implemented globally, nearly three quarters of the new infections could be prevented. The key is comprehensive action. Campaigns must simultaneously cover education, condom distribution, treatment for sexually transmitted infections, prevention of mother-to-child HIV transmission, the media, and support for orphans. A number of countries, including Thailand, Cambodia, Uganda, Brazil, Senegal, and Zambia, have shown that such programs can work, the UN says, and it's now up to other governments to follow suit.
Richard Black reporting. Opposition politicians in Britain have accused the Prime Minister Tony Blair of hypocrisy because his two eldest sons are said to have been receiving private tuition from teachers at one of London's top fee-paying schools. According to an article in the political magazine The Spectator, Ewan Blair, who's 18, and 16-year-old Nicky, who attend a state secondary school in West London, have been getting extra help with some subjects. A spokesman for the opposition Liberal Democrat Party said it showed Mr. Blair's lack of faith in the state system. The European Southern Observatory, an intergovernmental organisation that's fast becoming a world leader in astronomy, has just finished building a new $800 million observatory on a remote mountaintop in Chile. From there, astronomers will be expecting to be able to probe some of the secrets of distant galaxies in unprecedented detail. The BBC's science correspondent Christine McGerty has been to Chile to find out more.
I'm in the desert in northern Chile, but it feels a bit like I've landed on Mars. There's absolutely no life whatsoever. The place is completely barren, no animals, no plants, and the reddy brown landscape of stone and rocks just stretches before me in every direction. But up there at the top of the mountain are the four giant white telescopes that are putting this barren and isolated place right at the forefront of world astronomy.
It is very dry. It's one of the driest, in fact, it is the driest and most arid desert on Earth. We have very, very little precipitations, very, very clear skies, and we go up to 330 clear nights per year, which is almost unbelievable in terms of any site, and that was the reason why we came here.
At sunset, the observatory comes to life. The doors of the giant dome slide open and the $800 million telescope swivels into position to begin the night's work. It was built by a group of European countries who've clubbed together to form a consortium called the European Southern Observatory. And they say the new telescope, known rather unimaginatively as the Very Large Telescope, is quite simply the best in the world. The key reason for that is that it's actually made up of several powerful 8-metre telescopes working in tandem. Sarah Ellison is one of the British astronomers using it.
One of the things that's special about it is that there aren't just one of them, there are four of them. And so eventually the idea is to link all four telescopes together so that instead of having effectively one 8-metre eye, you can have a 100-metre eye by connecting all four together.
It cost $9 million, but not surprisingly, the scientists think it's worth every penny.
Christine McGerty in Chile. Medical research in Britain has shown that a drug commonly used to help patients with high cholesterol could also be extremely effective in protecting other people with normal cholesterol levels against heart attacks and strokes. The drug, known as a statin, is usually given to people with heart disease and raised blood cholesterol. But a study published in the medical journal The Lancet has now revealed that other people at high risk, such as diabetics, those with narrowing of the arteries in the legs, and those who've had a stroke, could also be helped by the drug. You're listening to the BBC in London. Today's main news: FBI officials have identified the gunman who shot dead two people at Los Angeles Airport before being killed by security guards from the Israeli airline El Al. They say he was an Egyptian limousine driver living in the United States. The government of Nepal says a number of people have been injured in a bomb blast at the offices of the new political party set up by the Prime Minister. It's 7:20 GMT. Sports news now. We're joined by Glenn Hicks.
Coming up in this roundup of world sport, it's Henman against Hewitt in the Wimbledon semi-finals, and the Williams sisters set their date with each other for the women's title. It appears to be the end of the road for the Arrows Formula One team, and can Maurice Greene find his Golden League touch again in Paris? At the All England Tennis Championships, Leighton Hewitt was forced to dig deep to book a place in the semi-finals against Tim Henman, while an unheralded Argentine is through to the last four as well. And the Williams sisters will meet in the final for a second Grand Slam in a row. Nishat Adat reports from Wimbledon.
We will indeed have an all-Williams final in the women's singles, the first time two siblings have met in a Wimbledon final since 1884. Serena booked her place with a ruthless 6-2, 6-1 win over Amelie Mauresmo, a victory that will make Serena the new world number one, leapfrogging Venus when the new rankings come out, no matter what happens on Saturday. But Venus, the defending champion of the last 2 years here, is looking near her best. She came through an awkward start against Justine Henin, her opponent in last year's final, to win 6-3, 6-2. And in a men's singles championship, which has at times been totally unpredictable, the one match most people expected to see will happen after all. Leighton Hewitt, the top seed, will face Tim Henman in the semi-finals. Hewitt came into his quarter-final with Sheng Shalken, having not dropped a set all championship. And when Hewitt raced to a 6-2, 6-2 lead, you got the impression he'd coast into the last four in straight sets yet again. In fact, Shalken saved match points in the third, but he went on to win the third set on a tie break and the fourth by 6-1. Hewitt hung on though, saving crucial break points to win the final set 7-5 and book his place in the semi-finals.
There was only one game in the third set I think that I didn't have a break point. The match sort of turned. He got confident. He was not making any mistakes that he made in the first, you know, 2.5 sets, and then he started stepping it up and, you know, it turned into a dogfight.
And Hewitt will now play Tim Henman, the big home favourite, who resumed his quarterfinal against Brazil's Andre Sá, leading by one set to love. But Henman then lost the second, with Sá playing some lovely shots, especially from the net. But Henman, willed on by the crowd, managed to turn things round to go through 6-3, 5-7, 6-4, 6-3.
Another win, the most important thing, obviously. I definitely give, I gave Sarr a lot of credit for his game beforehand, and I certainly give him even more credit afterwards, because I think played some really good tennis, made life very difficult for me.
Also through to the last four, the little-known Argentine David Nalbandian. The 20-year-old from Cordoba fought off a strong comeback from Ecuador's Nicolas Lapenti to eventually win 6-4 in the final set. He'll next meet Belgium's Xavier Malisse, who also needed five sets, against the 96 champion Richard Krajicek. Malisse won the final set by 9-7 after Krajicek had double-faulted to lose his serve at 7-all, thus ending his dream of winning the title for a second time.
Nishat Adat at Wimbledon. So, weather permitting, the top remaining seeds, Leighton Hewitt and Tim Henman, will battle for a place in Sunday's final. Looking ahead, here's Nigel Stalmer-Smith.
So this is it, the Double H semi-final, Hewitt versus Henman, seed 1 versus seed 4, as Britain's number 1 pitches for his first ever Grand Slam final against the world number 1. And for Henman, a fourth opportunity to go one better than before and become the first Briton to make a final since Bunny Austin in 38. For each, an uncomfortable path to the semis, but as Tim Henman says, the only thing that matters is the result, not how you achieved it. And by contrast, a place in the final awaits the winner between two players scarce considered possible Wimbledon champions at the start. It's been a fair tale for both of them. Number 27 seed Xavier Malisse, the new young Belgian star, conqueror of Rzeczki, and he faces the man ranked one below him, number 28 seed David Nalbandian of Argentina, and 1 year younger at age just 20. Another five-set quarter-final winner and another in uncharted Grand Slam territory. So, what a Wimbledon.
On to motor racing, and the Arrows Formula One team has just under 2 hours left to submit its cars for scrutineering. Otherwise, it will miss Sunday's British Grand Prix at Silverstone. Team owner Tom Walkinshaw has to find more than $5 million to settle his debt with engine suppliers Cosworth. The future of the team now looks far from certain. Here's Jonathan Ledyard.
Two Arrows cars arrived at Silverstone last night, awaiting official technical checks at this morning's specially extended 10 o'clock deadline. But unless Cosworth receive their money by that time, the cars won't turn a wheel in anger this weekend, and Arrows will be hit by a fine of around £500,000, and their long-term future will be hanging in the balance. As it is, Tom Walkinshaw is facing another legal battle today over a £2.5 million claim lodged by the former Arrows driver Jos Verstappen. Walkinshaw's already reeling from yesterday's crushing High Court judgment, which accused Arrows of insolvency, predicted the team's liquidation, and raised the prospect of creditors suing for fraud. No Formula One team has gone so long without winning. It's 25 years since Arrows started out. Now, their very survival could be measured in days or even hours.
Hein Verbruggen, the head of the International Cycling Union, says his sport will continue the fight against drug abuse. Jan Ullrich, who won the 1997 Tour de France, is the latest cyclist to fail a drugs test for amphetamines. With the Tour de France starting on Saturday, Verbruggen says the anti-doping efforts won't be diminished.
I always said, you know, we are sorry, you know, to have them, but it's a reality. And the thing is, it's like crime, you know, in normal society. It's you have to fight against it and to do your utmost, but on the other side, you, as Mr. Roger, the president of the IOC, recently said, you have to accept that you these things you'll probably never be able to eradicate completely. But I'm very sure, and we have the proof of that, you know, that big riders, the great riders, you know, who win the big events, they do this in a very clean way, and I'm very happy with that.
In athletics, the second of the season's Golden League meetings takes place at the Stade de France later today. There'll be plenty of attention focused on the men's 100 metres, with Maurice Green eager to bounce back from two recent surprise defeats. From Paris, here's Mike Costello.
After making so much history, Maurice Green is not about to start making excuses. His two defeats in Oslo and then in Sheffield within 48 hours came about, he says, because he simply wasn't prepared. As a remedy, he withdrew from a 100-metre race in Lausanne, Switzerland earlier this week and was gushing about the benefits of that much-needed rest when he arrived here in the French capital. He promises that he's back in the shape he took to the US National Championships 2 weeks ago when he recorded a wind-assisted 9.88 seconds to win, and he'll prove it on the track here at the Stade de France, he says. It's here that next year's World Championships will be staged, with Green going for an unprecedented fourth straight gold medal, and he's using this race as a barometer. Against him is the man who, in Green's absence, won the sprint double in Lausanne on Tuesday, Francis Obiquelu of Portugal via Nigeria, and the 19-year-old Briton Mark Lewis Francis, who finished way ahead of Green when taking second place in Sheffield last Sunday.
In golf, Carrie Webb's hopes of becoming the first player to win the US Women's Open for 3 years in a row were left in shreds after a disastrous opening round of 79 at the Prairie Dunes course in Kansas. She's 12 shots off the lead, held by three players, fellow Australian Shaney Waugh and the Americans Laura Diaz and Julie Ingster, who all shot 3-under-67. The latest triangular one-day cricket match between England and India at Durham was abandoned because of rain. India made 285 for 4 in their 50 overs. Sachin Tendulkar made 105 not out. England were 53 for 1 after 12.3 overs when the rain came. The triple overall World Cup skiing champion Hermann Mayer will join the Austrian team this month for his first squad training session in a year. Mayer missed last season, including the Salt Lake City Olympics, while he recovered from a broken leg from a motorcycle accident. And finally, just a reminder that Venus and Serena Williams will meet in the ladies' singles final at Wimbledon, while in the men's semis today it'll be Leighton Hewitt against Tim Henman and David Nalbandian versus Xavier Millis. And that's the sport.
Thanks to Glenn Hicks. Today's main world news, FBI officials have identified the gunman who shot dead two people at Los Angeles Airport before being killed himself. They say the man was a 41-year-old limousine driver from Egypt who'd lived in the United States since 1992. The gunman opened fire at the ticket counter of the Israeli airline El Al and was shot dead by airline security personnel. I'm Marion Marshall. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC in London.